in establishing a large-scale black soil supply community here in Cal, thanks to a lot of growers even using their fields, and we've had an incredible experience. Good, bad, things not working, things working. From rain to mongoose to whatever you want to imagine. And we've slowly developed everything. So for the last 2 weeks, and I wanted to share this with you, we've been actually feeding grubs live to chickens, and we've been supplementing their diet. Now, the experiment of the chickens is very basic. I basically have spoken to my landlord, who has 6 chickens, and said, I've got all these grubs. Can I feed them to your chickens? And basically, the grubs are completely, we make them in Cal, and I've been feeding them at home. And I wanted to take just 1 second before for Greg to say, how are your chickens?
This is a non-paid endorsement. No, Robert gave me a pretty good-sized quantity of the grubs about, I don't know, a week, 2 weeks ago. And I've been throwing a few in the morning. I give them my chickens a layer of crumbles, 2 or 3-way scratch, and then our, you know, the table scraps and stuff. And 6 chickens, I was averaging anywhere between, they don't lay as much as I thought they should with what I've been feeding them, maybe 1 to 3 eggs a day. Well, immediately, within those 2 weeks, was consistently 4 or 5 eggs a day. And not only that, but they changed their size. They got bigger. They consistently got bigger over time. And Robert has some here.
So everybody knows that these are the Kayla eggs that we buy, right? And so eventually, Greg's eggs started to come looking like this. So we said, oh, that's kind of nice. And then we got worried. Because I could hear the chickens.
Yeah.
And we started getting the eggs. So how common are we getting eggs like this
every
right
day?
Now? So we're overfeeding, obviously. But the wonderful part is it's not costing us anything except for actually labor of learning how to do the grubs. And so in that regard, that's why we brought Justin, because I want to do it better, and I know that you want to do it better. So Jeff has graciously said, you know, I will volunteer my time for the community. And so Jane and Mike Dupont got together and said, let's do a Black Soil Supply event for the community. Jeff has volunteered, the county volunteered the use of the facility. And so at this point, it's really up to you. So Jeff has a presentation. He is really good, not only on the technical, on the science side, but if you do not understand something, he can break it down to the part where I've been able to learn everything that I could from Jeff. So he's got about 15 papers that he's written on Black Soil Supply right now. Those are scientifically accredited papers. He is sourced by all kinds of guys. So in order to say that we're making a difference here on the Big Island, I wanted to say that one of the fundamental ways to make that change is through community. And so I've got 2 ways for you to get a hold of us and to keep talking after we're done, both on Twitter and Facebook. It's a / Black Soldier Fly, and you don't have to capitalize it, but it has to be one word, and then we can interact. And so if new events come up, that's a way that we're able to contact you very, you know, very easily. So just before we start, I wanted to, here's the big question. Why are we doing this? Obviously, I've shown you the egg. But this is really the reason, and I keep hammering this to everybody. What's cheaper, importing 3.3 pounds of feed or 12 eggs? Because that's what it takes a chicken to lay a dozen eggs. And so when I first came to Hawaii, Mindy from Waikiki Worm told me, come to Hawaii because our chicken industry is in crisis. And this was back in 08, 09, and the feed, the transportation costs just keep coming up, and every hatchery after that kept closing down.
Who are you? What's your name?
I'm Robert Olivier. Sorry, I've been running with some of the Black Soldier Fly stuff with Mike. I do it, sorry. And what we have seen is the first time I came to the island, I thought there was no chickens here. And the first island I set foot on was Hawaii. And the first thing I see is chickens everywhere. But I said, but why is it? that a farmer can't make money, why is it that the industry is bankrupting itself and needing subsidies when, at the end of the day, you're looking at an island ecosystem that is very able to sustain a chicken population? So before I continue, the secret ingredient is insects. And one of the easiest insects to cultivate is the black soldier fly. And so therefore we've got the world-renowned expert, Dr. Tom Lennon, and I just wanted to put him on the stage and let him do his magic, because it's quite amazing. So anyway, just thank you for your attention, and hopefully we can keep working from there.
Howdy.
All right. All right.
So Robert, you set the bar high for me. World renowned, notorious, I don't know, they go hand in hand. But it's definitely a pleasure to be here, and Robert, I appreciate the opportunity to come here and speak with everyone that's present tonight. Believe it or not, I do have some experience in Hawaii. I went to UH Manoa for part of my education, so it's never left me. It's always good to be back. So I have been working in decomposition ecology, I'd like to think, probably my whole life. I grew up on a farm in a two red light town in South Georgia. And I've seen how the economy's changed with time and where people go and what's happened to businesses in that area. And I grew up on a farm in a farming community, so I understand the significance of farming. One thing that I really have valued from that experience is what I learned from the farmers in that town. I still carry that with me today, but it's kind of interesting to talk about how I actually ended up with waste management. So I do decomp ecology, my undergraduate degree is from Georgia, I studied biology, but I was always interested in how things decompose. And I've never been able to trace the source of that interest, but I think it was because I grew up in the rural area and I was running around the woods all the time. And I study how things decompose, and I apply it in a lot of different areas. So I apply it partially in sustainable waste management. And I'll talk about waste management issues in Texas, but they're universal issues. And I'll talk about how we're trying to harvest that information or harvest that material to produce something that's of value to you or to other producers in that area. But I also apply it in another area, which is forensics. So I study how things decompose and apply that to determine how long people have been dead. You know what the most common question I get, though, is, did your wife know you did that before? Well, I was pretty cautious about telling her about what I did, but I had a book. But, I ended up going to Georgia. I came here for part of my PhD, then I went to the University of Georgia to finish my PhD, and I got a lot of really valuable experience. I worked a lot with layer facilities, and layer facilities in the state, generally, one layer facility is about 120,000 birds that put out about 80,000 eggs a day, and they also put out about 15 tons of manure per day. And I remember walking up to these facilities, and the birds are high-rise, so they're up high, and you open the basement, and you look in, and it's literally raining manure, and it's waist-deep. And I remember looking at my advisor, Dr. Shepard, and I said, Dr. Shepard, we have to go in there. And he said, no, Jeff. You have to go in there. So I learned by getting my hands dirty. And I ended up going to these facilities and working. What I found is that the biological fly did very well. In fact, there are times where I've been knee-deep in larvae inside of these facilities. So they really did well on weight. But if you haven't seen this video, this gives you an idea of what black soldier flies can do to a hamburger. Of course, it's time-lapse video. This is work out of Switzerland, so there's a lot of people that are interested in this green technology. The larvae will feed on a lot of different materials. They don't do as well on high-protein resources such as offal, fish offal, or meat. You have to blend it with some sort of carbohydrate product. But I was impressed that they could even eat McDonald's. When we think about agriculture, though, in the past, agriculture was very much input-driven. So when we think about row crops, if we think about beef cattle, dairy cattle, a lot of it was, well, what do we bring into the system? You know, fertilizer, antibiotics for the animals. You're constantly driving the system for maximum production. And then there was very little emphasis on the inherent strength of the system, because most ecosystems are, most people that do work in traditional ag focus on specific components of the system, but not the system as a whole. And one thing that I'm trying to do is I'm trying to work towards modernizing the philosophy. The idea is to reverse this trend, is to flip the pyramid and build a foundation that's strong on the inherent strength of the system. If we can take advantage of what nature is providing us and harness that energy, it may allow us to rely less on input, i.e. less on product being shipped here from the mainland so that you can produce a healthy sheep, cow, chicken, fish. If we do that, what we could create is a more stable system, which is a more predictable system. But the black hole reply, the idea is, if we can develop a system that harnesses the ability of these larvae to digest material, we know what we're putting in and we know what to expect on the other side consistently, know what we're producing in terms of larvae. Now, within agriculture in the 21st century, there are examples of this modern philosophy. When we think about pest management, we now use words such as suppression, acceptance, and monitoring. It's no longer the idea of eradication, 100% kill. There are thresholds that we can handle that allow us to tolerate them in the system. We integrate that with different practices such as sanitation, waste management, limited insecticide use, or nutrient management. And that does a lot for the system. One is it increases production, decreases financial investment, and at the end, it maximizes your returns. So what we want to do is look at what nature provides, figure out how the system works, learn how to harness that, and then utilize it to maximize the financial dividends that are returned to you. I mean, that's what I'm very much interested in. Now, animal agriculture in the United States is a pretty interesting environment. This top picture is right here. It's from Texas. This is a feedlot up in the Lubbock area. I learned an important lesson when I took this picture. When you get out of a car, take a picture of 100,000 cows at one site, you don't do that downwind because it's all blowing towards you. Literally mountains of manure, 50, 60, 80 feet tall. They go through 15 cars, train cars of feed every day. So a lot of feed going in and a lot of waste coming out. These dairies in Texas can range in anywhere from about 500 head up to 20,000 cows. When I first was hired at Texas A&M, my job was in extension, and I went to a dairy and I got out and I saw this giant mountain of manure, and the producer said, "How do I control flies?" And before I answered, I got in the car, and as I drove off, I said, "I'll let you know when I figure it out." Because there's really, I don't know what you would do in this situation. So in the state of Texas, these are some of the issues that we're dealing with. Texas ranks really high in livestock production. There are over 13 million head of cattle, 94,000 sheep. This is the number one horse producing state with a million. Big in chicken, egg layers, and broilers, dairy cows, hogs, lots of livestock. But it also has seven of the largest cities. So you have a lot of people and you have a lot of animals. So it's no different than if you're going to produce livestock here outside of Gila. If people are not used to it, people move here from the big city, they're not used to flies or something like that, it can cause a heated situation. Because while you look on one side and you see this beautiful landscape, you turn around and what you see on the other side is suburban development. And when those two come together, it can be quite heated. These are the issues that I deal with in Texas. I've been involved as an expert witness in cases where livestock facilities have been shut down because people don't want them near their home. So it's a pretty contentious issue. But where does the black soldier fly fit into this? So all of my research is on understanding how this fly can reduce waste, produce protein and fat that can be used for beef cuts. So this is the black soldier fly. It's a wasp-like in appearance fly. They look like wasps, form of mimicry. The only advice I can tell you, if you want to find out if it's truly a wasp or not, is if you grab it and it stings you, then yes, it was a wasp. If it does not sting you, then it's probably a soldier fly. I don't advise you to do that. But it is known as cyclone fly. It's found throughout the temperate and tropic regions of the world. Global. I did research on this fly in China. I worked with researchers from Switzerland, Central America. I try to understand this fly. It colonizes a variety of ways. Papers documenting this fly on everything from banana peels, human remains. It's been found to cause, to be found in fecal materials such as animals. So it's published. Publications indicate that it's found pretty much in most things. In the southern U.S., where it's temperate, it's active from April to October. So it's really restricted. Why is the perfect place? It's here, and it's active year-round. Now, most of the work that's been done has been done in poultry, as I mentioned earlier. And this is a California-style layer house, the manure collects underneath the bird. And what you find, if you look closely at the manure, you see something like this. Normally, the top 5 inches of the manure will be coated in soldier fly larvae. And what's pretty cool about it, and I'll show you in a minute, is you can harvest these larvae and use them as a feed substrate. The larvae can get up to about 1.5 inches in length. They can be quite large. I've seen them
kind of like a rainbow.
Not like that.
Branch.
It's pretty big. Then they turn black. It's really pretty. I'm biased. This is the system that my advisor developed for poultry. And the way it works is, as I mentioned, the manure collects in the pit. What he did is he put an incline, just a ramp, and the larvae disperse up this ramp because of their behavior. When they're ready to turn into an adult fly, they don't want to stay in the manure, so they leave. So they disperse, and what he did is he built a system where there's a piece of feed pipe up here with a slot cut in it. The larvae disperse up here, fall into the pipe, cross the end, fall into a bucket. So he developed a system where you could easily harvest black soldier fly larvae. Short story, when I finished my master's, I had a choice to go to 2 locations for my PhD. I could come to Hawaii, I could go to Georgia. I said, I'm going to Hawaii, people. I'll see you. So I came out here for part of it, but I went back and ended up finished with Dr. Shepard. So I've known Dr. Shepard for quite a while. This is a facility that he built in Tifton, Georgia. It could house 2,500 birds. And what he demonstrated, even in a temperate climate, is that he could use the black soldier fly to reduce waste in the facility. Well, what did he find? Colonization of animal waste with the black soldier fly can reduce it by 50%. Dry matter. Not moisture. Dry matter. Cut it in half. Nitrogen and phosphorus reduced by half. Taking it out. So if you're worried about pollution issues, you're removing it. Complete suppression of housefly. The presence of these larvae will inhibit houseflies from colonizing that way. Gets rid of houseflies. They self-harvest. I showed you how they climb up the ramp, go into the pipe. So you don't have to have a mechanization to collect them. 30% fat, 42%, 42% protein. So high fat, high protein. So it's a really good source of protein. I did a study a few years back and found also it reduced the E. coli salmonella. So pathogenic bacteria, knock them out, takes care of them. We found out recently, through some of the work that's been done in Korea, is that these flies are really good at killing gram-negative bacteria, which is interesting because most flies are good at killing gram-positive. Why that is important is that because they may be taking care of things that are more pathogenic to us than what other flies do. So because you'll often hear house flies touted as a system for waste reduction, protein production. Waste reduction, protein production. The big problem is they're loaded with bacteria. They love people. When a fly lands on your hamburger, it's going to do one of two things. It's going to throw up or it's going to defecate. It's going to leave about 10 to the 7 bacteria in the fly sick. And then you're going to eat it. You get sick. And then start all over, I guess. But it's not good. So the black soldier fly does not like people. They emerge, they mate, they lay eggs, they die. They don't go into people's homes, typically. The problem was we knew a little bit about how the soldier fly or what it did inside these facilities, but we knew nothing about its biology. And this gets back at that 21st century modern philosophy of agriculture. And that's where my research has focused for the past 15 years. And that is understanding the biology, trying to take these pieces of a puzzle and put them together in an image so we understand what it's doing in the environment. So we can harness that ability and maximize this ability to reduce waste. So I've done a lot of work on the development of fly. Typically, you can collect these eggs, and I'll show you in a little bit how you can collect them. They take 3 or 4 days to hatch. The larva will take about 14 days to go from hatch to the dispersal phase, or pre-pupa. Once it forms the pupa, it takes another 14 days before the adult emerges. And then the adult lives for about 14 days. They don't feed, the adults don't. They rely on fat body reserves to maintain themselves while they're alive. The female will lay a single batch of eggs, and then she will die. So they're most of their time is spent in the larval phase. Why aren't they a pet? Why don't we see them coming into home? And where are they going when they emerge? So we're talking literally after 15 years of people coming in house to work. So a couple things that I found is that the adults like to left. This is an example of an adult on a plant. Lefting means that they like to aggregate. They come together. The males are very territorial. They'll find a spot on a plant and sit there, and a female flies over and grab her and mate. So the male makes a spot. I also found that it was sunlight driven. What that means is that they need a lot of sunlight to mate. They don't have sunlight, they don't mate. They don't need sunlight as much to oviposit, to lay eggs, but they generally lay their eggs in the morning time. That's when you see a lot of activity, the day progresses, that's usually held off. But that explained a lot of what we were seeing, and that was they like to lek, so they have a very short adult life, so what they were doing is going to emerge as an adult, they go into the woods, they find somewhere to sit, and they're looking for a mate. That's objective number one, to find a mate. Then once they mate, the female is at the mating, she'll want to lay eggs. So she comes back to the facility, lays her eggs, and dies. Typically, the male only mates once as well. So it's a one-time gig. Mate, produce offspring, die. This is an example. This is another paper that we published looking at collection of eggs. We developed a method where you can actually harvest the eggs. So what we would do is we would have these adults in a cage, lots of sunlight so they could fly around and mate. Then what you would do is take a bucket, some sort of waste product in it with a lot of water so that the fly can get into the water, or get to the substrate because of the water and it's a barrier. And you would take this corrugated cardboard to the inside. And what they do is the female will come in and she'll lay her eggs in that cardboard. So each one of these little flutes right here is 400 eggs. In a colony that measures 6 feet wide, 6 feet long, so 6 feet wide, 6 feet high, 12 feet long, we could produce 360,000 eggs a day. Now, if a larva gets to 0.2 grams, that's a lot of larvae that you can put in a small colony. But you can harvest these eggs in this cardboard, and then if you're using some sort of compost facility in your own home, just put the cardboard in, it'll break down anyway, so they hatch, you inoculate the facility. Something else I found is that these flies are... There's questions?
Yeah. Oh, yes, sir. You said you put water around the substrate to keep them from going into it, so you...
what it was like a stew.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it was just in that water.
So it was a waste product. We used grain diet.
Uh-huh.
And like land mash is really important. We saturate and put it in the bucket and put a little bit of layer of water right above it.
Okay.
Because the fly would want to lay eggs in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you put the water in there, there would be somewhere else to lay eggs. So it would put it in to attract them. Because they're looking for somewhere to lay eggs. And that brings them in. And then once they've laid, I'll show you some data in a little bit. Some more recent studies where we're finding out what's driving those positions, bacteria related.
So
Substrate? We use like grain diet, but you could take kitchen waste. You could take animal feces if you wanted, if that's what you had, like chicken waste. You put that into a bucket and just mix water into it, saturate it, and then you tape that cardboard to the inside, and the females come in and lay eggs in that cardboard. So it works really well. I remember going out to talk to my daddy one time, and he lived in a small town, and I was out at his house on a dirt road in Illinois, and I had a couple of larvae, and a female came in and tried to lay eggs in the cardboard. Out of nowhere. But with the toxicology things, I found that these flies are extremely susceptible to insecticides. They're very sensitive to insecticides. So if you're interested in using this technology or using the screen technology, you want to be really careful because they're very susceptible. They're like a canary in the cave. Very low doses will kill them. In fact, they're so susceptible that when I compared them to a colony of house flies that's been maintained for over 30 years, and not exposed to insecticides, purposely to have a control colony, something really susceptible, these flies were 10 to 30 times more susceptible than this colony of house flies. They're extremely susceptible, but I didn't understand why. But it made sense once I figured out the biology, and that was they spend very little time in the facility. They only return to lay eggs. So they're never exposed to the insecticides, so they're able to cycle without being selected for resistance. They're extremely susceptible. So what did I find? I said, well, we found that when adults emerge, they typically seek a lesion site. They'll mate after 2 days. Then after an additional 2 days, the females will return and they'll lay their eggs. And then they'll die. The larvae reduce the manure, our waste product. They will reduce fly populations. They will reduce microbial populations. They will reduce pathogens. The pre-pupae can be self-harvested, and then, as Robert pointed out, with this giant egg, they can be used as feed. When he showed me this, I just felt bad for the chicken. That's a big egg. So they can be harvested. It's a very simple system to use. What we see today is something that Robert and his family have developed, and that's the biopod. And these are, what, Robert, around the world?
Yep.
People around the world are using them. They're really nice as a home. We've done some work on the nutritional value of these larvae. See, we use them in the aquaculture industry to see if we could use them for rainbow trout diet. And we also looked at the effect on the quality of the rainbow trout. So if you feed them pupae, does the fish end up having a peculiar taste to it or not versus something that's reared on a standard diet? And this work was done in Ireland. And what I'm going to do is just point out a few things. This is fish meal with anchovies, bicolor fly pupae, domestic house fly pupae, because I mentioned that people suggest this is an alternative for green technology for protein production. Corn, gluten meal, soybean meal. And what you'll notice is that black shoulder fly is up here with fish meal in terms of dry matter. So per volume, you get just as much dry matter as you would with fish meal. If you look at the crude protein, it is substantially less than fish meal. It's at 43% versus 72%. And it is less than these other groups. In terms of lipid concentration, though, it's really high in lipids, really high in fat. And that plays into what we did with the fish in a minute. And then with ash, what we found is that it's common. Why was that important to do this work? Well, what we found is we could not feed the pupae as the sole diet to the fish. Too fat, too much fat. So what we did is we found that we could do a 30% replacement. So we could reduce the dependency on international fisheries by 30% with this fly. Think about fuel costs going out to the international fisheries harvesting fish. Think about 30% of the international fisheries that are being depleted. This potentially could replace that, 30%. When we did this work, the fish grew at the same rate, the same size, and had the same quality. I did not participate in the fish tasting trial, but they did a blind study with some people in Idaho and found that there was no difference in choice. They felt they tasted the same. So it is comparable to fish meal, and it is an alternate protein source that can be used with fish. Dr. Shepherd, I asked him why not use it with cattle, and he felt that it's too valuable. He said for like dairy cattle, beef cattle, swine, he said it's too valuable of a product to feed them. So where do we go from here? Well, there are currently, just to give you an idea of who's doing work on black loaded flies, there are people in Canada, mainland USA, and Washington State, myself in Texas, Switzerland, Germany, Thailand, China, the UK, Indonesia, and of course now Hawaii. Hawaii does offer probably one of the more premier environments for raising the fly because of the weather conditions and the fact it's already established. But why else? Well, the weather conditions are important. You have 12 months of sunshine. So unlike in the mainland U.S. where I am, I can get maybe 8 months of work, and then I have to move into a greenhouse, which is fine for research purposes, but for economic purposes, it's not, because burning that much gas to keep it warm is not worth it. You have plenty of sunlight. You have materials for mass rearing available here in the state. There's plenty of waste products if you think about what you produce in your own kitchen, if you think about what's produced in the school systems, other restaurants, the material is available that can be used. Any kind of offal that's produced from slaughtering can be recycled through this process. But what's the current focus of my life? Where am I going? Well, we're talking about producing pre-pupae that can be used as food. Well, I'm really interested in microbiology. And I just want to show you a little bit about the microbiology and how I think that can benefit the use of the black polar fly. So one thing is looking at microbial factors that affect attraction and colonization, because for some reason these females are aggregating and then will lay their eggs together. So when we think about community ecology, we think about a pyramid system. At the bottom we have plants, then we go up to animals and humans, and some people might suspect that zombies are at the very top. But what we're interested in is understanding the interactions between these different groups. And that's something I'm really into with my lab, my graduate students. And what we find is that most work focuses on multicellular organisms, very little focuses on the microbes. There was a really nice article published by Dan Jansen back in the 70s that said, you know, microbes are underappreciated. Most people think of microbes as recyclable, but they've been here a lot longer than we have, and they probably do a lot more than we do. Think about it when you have milk spoil in your refrigerator. Do you like to drink sour milk?
Raw milk sour is a different way to...
Yeah, it does. So does organic milk. It does different things, at least what I've seen. But most people would say no. Most. But the idea is that the bacteria that are in that milk have done things to it to make it less appealing to you. It's like a banana. When it's spoiled, so you want to eat it, no, but the microbes will. So we have to think differently about what microbes do. So really, there's another layer down here, which are the microbes. And that's a new area of focus. And we think about microbes not only being at the bottom, but at the top. By animation, people take off, right? But microbes are now replacing, are creating a new trophic layer and understanding how ecosystems work. If you think about mosquitoes, their oviposition behavior is regulated by bacteria. If we think about maggots on something dead, their oviposition is regulated by bacteria. So why wouldn't the soldier fly be the same way? So one thing that I did is I looked at, well, how microbes are being used in decomposition. And I promise you there is a reason for this. What we found is if you sterilize the diet, the flies aren't attracted to it. Okay, so microbes are important there. With the eggs, what we found is if you sterilize the eggs, the flies aren't attracted to them. If they're non-sterile, the adult females will go and lay eggs with them. So something about the non-sterile eggs is attracting more females to lay eggs. We also found that when we isolated the bacteria off of the eggs, that when we worked in community level, not just individual species, we got greater response of the flood, the bacteria. And what we did is we identified a lot of this work using KIT, but we do a lot of high throughput sequencing, some pretty cutting-edge technology on the molecular side as well. And this is just an example of the KIT. So basically, you expose the bacteria and you'll get these different color patterns, and it's as well as E. coli, based on the color pattern. So in this study, what we did is we went to the genetic level. We actually looked at 16S ribosomal DNA sequences. We looked at the DNA of the microbes to figure out what they were. And we compared these molecular and phenotypic ID methods. So what we did is we got AIDS-associated bacteria collections. So what we did is we put AIDS in test tubes, and we washed them in sterile water. And we took that water and played it. And we got all kinds of great stuff off of it, all these different cultures going. So we could, based on color pattern, we could isolate it. So you see here the different colors. We could isolate these colonies. And then we could see what they were. We could see how the adult flies responded to them. So what is this? This is a container with some media in it, with cardboard attached to the inside. The flexibility we talked about a lot longer. So which one do you think is more attractive to females laying eggs? This one, or this one? The one on the left, right? Lots of females laying eggs. What we found, let's get the cool here, is that when we use just the standard buffer, which was put here, we used different concentrations of bacteria, and we measured the number of eggs laid based on the type of bacteria and the amount of bacteria. And what we found is that with certain bacteria at this high concentration, we could really get a lot of oviposition. So the reason I'm showing this is because where I'm trying to lead is the development of a synthetic compound that you could actually apply inside of your unit and get the females to come lay eggs. Instead of sitting there waiting, keeping your fingers crossed that the females are going to come, hopefully it's something that I can develop that will be available to you to use to really get females coming in and laying eggs in your unit. So that's something I'm interested in doing. This is some data that we generated that's pretty interesting just to show you how these flies interact. This is two different blowflies, so different species, and this is the black soldier fly. And these are different bacteria across the bottom. The thing that I want to point out is that when we were looking at the response of adult females to bacteria from different species, this is the response we typically got. And what that is saying is that when certain bacteria from competing species were present, the flies avoided it. They stayed away from it. But if it was bacteria from their own species, they were attracted to it. But it was concentration dependent. What I mean, and why that's important to you, is because if you're doing waste management and other flies are coming in and colonizing, it's going to affect black soldier fly attraction. So you want to be careful about how you manage your waste, how you process it, because if you see other flies coming in and laying eggs, or you see other maggots that are not black soldier flies, it's going to take away from the optimal production of your unit, because black soldier flies might avoid it. One thing that was really cool was we worked with a mixture of bacteria. And this was important because what we found is that it's not the individual bacteria. This gets at, again, the sustainability of a system. It's the whole system that's important. When we worked with a mixture of bacteria, what we found is that we had greater levels of attraction. So the reason that's important to me is because I know that when I'm developing a synthetic, not to rely on a single bacterium, but look at what the whole community is producing. And that's what we're working on right now. And this is just some of the data that we generated from the bacteria. These are different bacteria types, and this is percent oviposition, and this is the mixture. And what we found is that as we increased in density, the amount of eggs that were deposited increased. So we found that this high concentration of bacteria would be really important for getting the oviposition. Oviposition, what we found is that bacteria, different species of bacteria were important. Ignatian areas, the genus of bacteria that's really good for attracting black soldier flies. The mixture was really important, so not just individual species. We're really concerned about what bacteria are there and what techniques used to identify them because we got a lot of variable results. And the reason that's important, the reason we're really interested in this end of the spectrum is because If you're going to use something as a feed, you want to know what bacteria are affiliated with it. If you're going to feed it to a chicken or you're going to feed it to a bird, and then you, if you're going to feed it to a chicken or to a fish, and you're going to eat those, you want to know what you're giving them. You want to know if you're giving them something that's going to be bad. And the good news is that what we found so far is that black soldier flies tend to suppress most of the pathogens that we recognize associated with livestock, like salmonella and E. coli, which is really good. But we're still doing work on that now. So, in conclusion, the black soldier fly is an established system. This is something that dates back 30, 40 years. But I think what we're finding is through people such as Robert that are willing to invest their time and energy in the field with producers and get the system running, it has the opportunity to take off. We know that the black soldier fly is a sustainable system. We have seen, at least when I've done research for 9 months of the year, that we can maintain a consistent colony, colonizing waves throughout the year, producing feed. Work in China in this area is looking at on a more commercial level. Their goal is to create 7 reactors, each reactor producing 50,000 pounds of pre-PUB per year. That's a lot of protein. That's what China does. You don't have to do that. You can do a small reactor and produce 50 kilograms per year, and that's a lot for chickens or fish. With that, I want to thank Robert for the invitation. I want to thank you for coming out in the rain tonight and giving me an opportunity to come here and speak. Robert has my information. I can put my email address up here so you can have it. And if you have any questions about black soldier flies that Robert cannot answer, or Mr. DuPont, or anyone, you know, you're welcome to contact me. So I'd be glad to come out here and answer your questions first. Thank you. Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
How does the black soldier fly react with IMO in the soil?
How do I? Robert?
Well, not good. What was the question?
Not good.
How does black soldier fly react to IMO?
IMO knocks out most flies. IMO is the material used in the pig pens for the Korean National Flowering. And what's so wonderful about those pig pens is they're odorless. And they don't have flies. Even when I went to Korea, the only place I saw flies was on the feeding trough. And so initially I said, oh, I want an odorless black soldier fly bed. I'm going to put IMO in there. And what I got was basically a bed without flies. So again, there's something within that microbial community of that IMO that doesn't work well with most fly species, including the black soldier fly. Now, I don't have fancy genetic data like Dr. Thomas does, but just from observation here in Hawaii, I hope that would answer your question.
Yes.
What's the angle that needs to be on that dispersal ramp? It's too steep, they won't make it up.
That's a good point. What is the angle on the dispersal ramp? It's usually around 30 degrees.
Okay. And then the food stuff that you feed out, is that... is there like a certain ratio of carbohydrates, protein, better than others?
Well, you know, that's the research that I'm hoping to do here, is actually figure that out and figure out how to optimize nutritional input for the larvae. Mm-hmm. What I can tell you is that when we work with straight, like dairy waste, they can develop on it, but it took about 30% longer in time, and the larvae were about 30% smaller. When we worked with straight meat, it took about 4 times as long to complete the development, but they were huge. They're huge, but they took forever. And the thing about that I worry about is rancid, the meat going rancid and then you get a lot of odor.
And then the protein, you said that you could substitute for 30% on the fish. For a chicken, would that be the same percentage or?
I don't know what the percent would be for chicken. I don't know the diet of a chicken, but there's a paper done by Hale in 1973 that looked at chicken production with black soldier flies. I can look that information up and provide it for you. Robert, you want to say something?
Yeah, that's research that we will be doing this year. So I'm very happy to announce that we got a USDA grant, SBIR, and our phase one is exactly that. Because even the Hale paper from 1972 only fed it for about a week. We've just exceeded that by 2-week trial right here at my house. It's only 6 chickens, so that's not enough. So what I'm doing is we're working with Farming Forages up in Maui, and we're going to be testing in all populations of 15 chickens at a time over 3 years, and the chickens are already 1 year old. So they're in egg-laying production. So what we're really hoping to get the data for is the relationship between a black soldier fly feed and the amount of eggs that you're getting. And so nobody has done that. And we really hope to be doing that and be a pioneer in that. And that puts Hawaii on the map. And so it's those types of efforts and research that eventually could lead to further development. But the thing is I really believe that, like Tom Berlin is saying, is agriculture is not just only input-driven. It's driven as an ecosystem. And that's what the black soldier fly is able to do, is to be like Kauai, is that the island can sustain a chicken. So let's make an industry that can also sustain a chicken. And I believe the black soldier fly.
The thing that's really cool about the black soldier fly, I mean, there's nothing to gain from this monetarily for me. I believe in the system. I mean, I've seen it work. And the fly is here, and it's in the perfect environment for the fly, and you have the resources for it. Very little investment to generate free pupae, which could be a really nice feed source for livestock. Everything you need to be successful with this fly is right here.
So if we were just to ignore the issue of how Longwalk takes the large data reach a certain size and how large, are there just any limitations? Like, oh, if I'm only going to be feeding them vegetable scraps, is it still possible that they'll end up being a complete protein source for the poultry and stuff?
I think it comes down to what kind of vegetables you're feeding, because, you know, beans and things can be high in protein, so you can have protein sources. The thing is, what we found too is like soldier flies do well on plant material, but there's got to be a protein source in it.
Okay.
They do better on plant material than they do on meat material.
So it's kind of do like what people do, blend, you know, meat icing with
I really believe that black soldier flies, in terms of their natural history, are more plant oriented, which explains why they do so well. Yes?
Maybe this will help everybody. There's a golden rule for raising chickens that an adult chicken, about the age that Joe Robert was on, about a year old, would consume a third of a pound of feed a day.
Okay.
Of that third, a third of that would be greens, a third of that, or a ninth of a pound, would be grains, and the other third would be protein.
Okay.
Average percentage of protein for a chicken is about 16%, during laying is about 20%. And if black soldier fly is 40%, you could substitute something else and bring down just the black soldier fly a lot of feed less. You get more greens, as you said, fruits, vegetables, and other items to decrease the amount that they're getting.
You know what's interesting about that, too, is that we've seen pupae produced from this fly that can range from a quarter of an inch in length up to an inch and a half in length. So there's a lot of variability in there in terms of what you're producing. So you could customize the larvae.
And I have a question that just was added in that. My question was, how much waste does it take to produce, let's say, one pound of black soldier fly?
That's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head. I know the literature is, I know it's there, but I don't know. Robert, do you have data on that?
You see numbers all over the place, but I think if there's a good protein source there, then you will have a better development of the larva, and you'll have a better yield of larva. But also, we think that there's a bacteriological element there. So an experiment that we did, every day we weigh what goes in, how much did I get out, what goes in, how much comes out. So the first 6 weeks, the system's starting up, and I start really slow, okay? And I just use my nose a lot. I don't want it to get rancid. And so my conversion ratio was really low, 5-10%. Now, it takes a colony not very long to establish. It's a 2-3 week run. It's really, really easy to get the black soldier fly population just boom. But every time we did this, 6-8 weeks, something happened. And then, we're looking back at the data, that's at that time period, yield shot up to 15-20% waste. Now, this is with food waste.
Okay, so I just want to point that out. Because, for example, if you do manure at a time of cellulose, your reduction is not as high, so your yield is also not as high. But if I work with food waste, then almost pure nutrients and 80% moisture, that reduction is huge. So it depends how much water is in there.
So I can see that like a standard experiment I did with land mash. So you know what's in land mash. We fed 20 grams to 300 larvae, and they averaged completion in 14 days. I can give you an idea of what's going into it.
Standard larvae weigh about how much?
About 0.2 grams per maggot. How many larvae?
Is there an ideal diet for a black soldier fly?
Ideal? I don't think we know specifically an ideal. I mean, artificial diets like land mash are great, but you don't want to waste land mash on that. I can't say that we've identified a specific, like this is the...
Well, like the, this gentleman was saying, so much protein, so much plant material, I don't know. Did you have an idea in the preventative like that?
Well, that's where we're hoping to go, because the grant that would allow me to do this work, which I'll know in the next couple weeks, is that there's called geometric frameworks, carbohydrates times protein, and we'll vary those ratios and find out which gives that perfect axis down the middle, and be able to say this is what the protein-carbohydrate ratio should be. And then you can go with, okay, I know I need to be around this range.
And I have one more on to attract the females. We don't have the scientific wherewithal to try to place the bacteria you're looking for.
Right.
But in practical terms, what's the best attraction?
I would say the best thing you could do is if you know someone that has black soldier flies as an active colony, is to get a scoop of the waste with some of the maggots and inoculate. Yeah. Do an inoculum into your bin, and that would help get the females coming in.
There's no like layer mass or something like that you've used over the years that you find is ideal?
No, it's hit or miss on that, because you can get a lot of other things coming in colonizing. But if you know someone that has soldier flies, active, just get a scoop of their waste with some maggots, and that'll help get things going.
I might know something.
Yeah. So I think it's not going to be. Yes?
How long are the eggs lasting
for? 4 days. So they do have a minimum temperature threshold of around 53 Fahrenheit. If you drop below that, it'll kill them. But they're really cool because they 4 days to hatch. So you can collect them and you can hold them for a while. So one thing that you may want to do as a community is to have a colony of flies and you can collect eggs for distribute eggs by tens of thousands. Pretty easy. Yeah.
So in those buckets with media and the cardboard, you watch those take the cardboard out and then the larvae would die and fall down.
Well, they would feed and they would develop in there.
But as long as the water layer there, will they be able to handle that?
They can handle a low oxygen environment. The question was, you just pull the cardboard out before the larvae fall into the bucket of water. You do want to pull that cardboard. And it's easy. If you want to try that, if you have some grain diets or something that's gone bad, you get nice and wet, put it in a container, strap some cardboard to the inside, put it outside. You can check it daily. You'll see the eggs and the flukes if they're there. I should be in the sunlight, but what I typically do is that I put a piece of cardboard over the top of the bucket, like a shade. So it's out in the sun, but the cardboard acts as a shade, the flies go up under the cardboard. Yes?
It doesn't matter if it's getting aerobic or anaerobic in your soldier fly bin.
It does. It really does. They don't do well in anaerobic environments. Robert's finding that with his work is anaerobic is just not very good. In fact, one of the limiting factors for large-scale production of soldier flies, that they tend to stay on the layer at the top, a couple inches of waste. They don't go down into it. So that's been a limitation to the system on large scale. You got a question, ma'am, in front?
No, I guess I'm just curious about different types of feedstock, because we don't have those huge factory farms, and we don't have access to that large amount of manure. I mean, if we were going to scale this up, to, you know, farm level, not just the home level, what type of feedstock do you see on this island that would be available and approved?
For the larvae?
Yeah, for the larvae.
So I'm going to defer to people that have worked. Yeah. Mike? Yes?
You know, I'm really interested in that salmon study that you guys just presented.
Yes.
At 30% or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a feed that's actually being made right now?
for the salmon using that?
No, there is not. There isn't.
That's, if that, you said, yeah, we'll be on our way tomorrow.
Yeah, this is the thing, is developing a unit that can produce the feed here if the soldier fly are produced.
No, I just need one feed in the whole United States or any place that says soldier fly on the label.
Ah, yeah.
Or some kind of grub on the label.
Sure.
Once I get that,
right, I see what you're saying. Sure. I understand.
And that's the challenge I think we're going to have, Robert and I, and me, when we start trying to make the feed.
To go large scale, sure.
And, you know, we're a pioneer, you guys are the pioneers of this good. And it's going to happen. It's just that it's going to take some time and a lot of education, what you guys are doing now, showing us that soldier flies are safe, they do not cause diseases, they can be reared real easily. All of that education has to be done. Not only these people like us in the room, but the regulators. Because when you work with the regulated people, they don't understand this.
Mm-hmm.
The first question they're going to ask, you're going to ask them, the answer is going to
be no. Okay. Exactly. I agree.
I'm just saying, like, a lot of the food is already being fed to pigs already, like all the waste from the schools, from the stores, everything pretty much.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean?
That
so
is,
where are you saying this
that
coming
is,
from?
Well,
that's the challenge.
That's the challenge. I could do this. See, in order for this to take off, it's going to take community.
Yeah.
I couldn't do this without the help of Cafe 100, Richard's family. Okay? Because the first day I picked up waste, Mike gets a phone call from a pig farmer. And it sets off a chain reaction. And because, you know, he's got a sow. And the moment I took it that waste, I bumped into that territory. And so one of the things are the perceptions that I want to change is, for example, a lot of people feed food waste to their chickens. But then what you see is, and they supplement it with a little bit of feed. And then what you see is you really have an average performance. And so the same thing is happening with pig farming. Is you got an average performing pig. The only way to make money truly as a pig farmer is to take the wean offs and sell them at $150 a piece. But you're not growing pigs to their full carcass size. Because why is it? Because if you take our food waste, what happens when you feed us a lot of our food waste? We go this. But we don't look like Ken and Barbie at the end of the day. We're not a prime quality meat. You need a high protein. Our food weight, so our pigs are resembling our own obese culture. And so this food waste is not the ideal source. So what happens here in Hawaii is people generate sows to have cakes, you know, quinoas. Then they go back to the mainland. They get fat there. Because the feed is cheaper. And then they get put in boxes and shipped back to us.
Just like cattle.
So, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the problem is the time it takes to create a high-value meat out of an adult carcass or an adult pig takes forever on food. So even me saying, hey, I need your slop, and I get trampled upon because, this is my territory. At what point, as this research continues, as we create a feed label that says Black Soldier Fly Meat, I believe that I'm going to see enhanced growth, also in pigs. And if I can show enhanced growth, then it becomes to getting a pig to carcass quality, where pig farmers get top dollar. And if that top dollar, somebody pays a little bit for my Black Soldier Fly, then it's worth it. He could still feed slop. But you got to let low on those carbs, and you got to up that protein, and that pig's going to grow quicker and better and healthier. So it's like I said, in order to get access to it, it takes community. And so, you know, as researchers, we have to work together to get the idea out that we can make better pigs on this island. The Hawaiians are very proud of being pig farmers. A lot of people put their heart and soul into it. And at the end of the day, they really don't do it for the money. And so if we had a way to have a high protein additional feed additive, that's how we want to get there. So eventually, to answer your question, I've worked with people, and them becoming waste service people, in other words, it takes a lot of work to actually go get waste, to go get it all done, to get it. It needs an economy of scale. That actually might just by itself be a profession. And I want to call that profession insect farmers. They're still swapped, they're still insects. And that can then funnel up to where the point is that, you know, farmers, they want to buy a feed. They don't want to do every step. They don't want to become entomologists. And that's what I've learned being here for over a year is, yeah, it's, we need the entomologist. That's why I brought Jeff here. I paid for him to come here so that we can say, let's do this smartly and let's get well organized. And that so in order to get the feed, I think that if we can show the benefits for everybody, hopefully with the pig farmers and everybody, we can say we can all exist together and get it done. Now, on Oahu, not a problem. Way too much food waste, not enough pigs. But on the Big Island, it is challenging. And our research is not shying away from going after slaughterhouse waste and the stuff that the pig farmers can't get. But again, that should be done by a professional. It's harder to do that as a small farmer.
I think I would need to know what kind of resources are available. I'm not sure of what is out there.
Limited, that, yeah, anything like that, the big farmers have been
mentioned.
You've been already. You said you can use awful, but it doesn't give good results.
You'd have
that,
to.
Could you expand on that a little
bit?
That's
awful. Well, straight awful is too much of a good thing.
Okay,
too much
so
protein.
So what would you make of it?
You'd have to have some kind of carb. Yeah. Awful, yeah. So I mean, why not? I think it's worth trying. Those are two resources no one's using. Why not try it and see what happens? Because, again, what I would imagine would be high on papaya and low on the fish off, I mean, on the
okay.
The offal. Do you, is that from swine or is it from beef or what's it?
Poultry. I'm doing
poultry.
Poultry?
So, broilers. Okay. I was thinking layers would be easy to get.
Yeah, but like.
Sure. Yeah, what about the compost from the worm or from the black soldier?
That's good. That's really interesting. Sure. I'm glad you brought that up. Is that there is white soldier?
Is it like worms? Is it mesophilic? Where it'll outdo the bacteria in the soil?
What I can say is that what we found with waste produced from dairy manure, what was left over wasn't high enough quality to raise plants on. In fact, we found that.
So it's pretty new.
The nutrition wasn't as good, but I didn't do anything beyond that. What we did is we collected the waste that remained after digestion and grew some tomato plants. See what happened, and they didn't do very well. It didn't, but...
Did you guys do, like, a microbial...
No, that was before I got into the microbiology. But I will say this was interesting. They dried that stuff out so much it looked like sawdust.
Okay.
And that was dairy manure.
So,
I mean, it looked like sawdust.
Would it be more so organic matter versus actual compost? What would you say?
I'm not sure. But I would say remove so much nitrogen and phosphorus, I don't know what the value of it would be.
Okay.
But it is pretty dry. The question at the end?
Yeah, so if the part of the idea is rather than say food waste to chickens, to feed it to soldier flies to get a protein
enhancement,
then feed that to chickens, where is the protein coming from? Where is the nitrogen coming from?
It's coming from the waste.
So when you fed it directly to the chickens, the nitrogen was either in the protein in the first place.
Right, so what they do is they're taking manure and converting it to a usable protein that would be more likely consumed by the birds. Because chickens are effective horses, they like that. So what we're doing is taking a waste product that.
So when you
one thing that's really good, this is just a side note, omega-3 fatty acids are pretty important. Fish also flow with omega-3 fatty acids, and they're highly unstable, and they lose a lot when they clean the fish, they throw the offal out or use it in something else, but they lose a lot of the omega-3 fatty acids. Sophie found in one of our studies when we were collaborating, she found that fluid flies can harvest the omega-3 fatty acids and stabilize the omega-3 fatty acids inside of their gut and their bodies. And then, if we could find out how they do that, that'd be pretty cool. But then you store, you freeze-dry those larvae and it stabilizes the omega-3 fatty acids. So it was a pretty cool discovery. Now, how they do that, we don't know. But it does save a lot.
Can you tell me about the composition of the larva? Is it more of a wet larva, or is it drier when you hold it? Or?
Oh, they're dry. I mean, if you were to get one out of a bin and hold it, they're real dry. They put calcium carbonate, their exoskeletons are really rough. They're real tough. They're real leathery. And they get really big. It's an awesome fly.
Would it be more practical to do a batch method or a continuous
method? That's a great question. Batch versus continuous. Most of my work is on batch. That's the way I operate it. But the natural systems are all on continuous method. Continuous. So it's constantly producing. And what Robert's doing is he's developing techniques where it's like modular units. So you can, if you clean the unit, you can. But you have other units that are going at the same time. But you say continuous. I mean, this is constantly.
Yeah, and I actually I've questioned a lot of what they do in the lab many of times because, like I said, I would see increases in production 6 to 8 weeks afterwards, and that's continuously putting new material on there and watching it be. So for me, why would I want to restart colonies constantly when I feel that the homeostatic, all well-balanced, good-smelling colony is reached after only 2 months? So I feel, personally, and I'm not a scientist like Jeff. I don't have a lot of data, but I'm more an artist in that sense. He's a scientist. I feel that I don't think that the system's really going until you've done it for 2 months.
Yeah, so the batch system, the reason I do that is a lot of people have more data. I can do replications. If you look at the natural system, the poultry houses, well, that's continuous, constantly running.
Would they continuous? Do you have to switch out the waste from the flies every now and then?
Sometimes you might have to clean the system out. I mean, that's a possibility. I mean, there's going to be organic matter left over, but I think it takes a long time. Robert, I think, believes that you don't have to.
I believe that.
What's the longest you've been able to sustain a colony in your life?
Well, every time I go to the mainland, I crash.
every couple of weeks.
Sorry about that. It depends because. Like I said, the moment I stop feeding, I crash.
So, but it's not duck crashing because it's crashing or collapsing itself. It's crashing because of neglect.
Yeah.
Okay.
The cool thing is the adults do not feed. I mean, the way we designed our system, it was a mesh cage that I told you was 12 feet long, 50 high, 6 feet wide. We ran a PVC pipe down the middle that had sprinkler heads on it, two of them missing heads, that cut off twice a day for 15 minutes just to miss the cage to provide a water source. We would come in and leave the adult and leave. Then every day I would come in and put a bucket with cardboard, put it in there, collect eggs for 2 hours, pull it out. That's all it is, every day. So it's really easy. Very little input, and you still collect tens of thousands of eggs.
And then your eggs, then
that's an interesting point. So what we would do is we take the eggs, put them in a container, an empty container. And after 4 days, you go and look, and they hatch. And then I put like a couple spoonfuls of moist media in there. And then I would ease them along. But that was for me to be doing things in the lab. But technically, you could take those eggs, at day three, day four, toss them on your compost top, and the egg would hatch and go, and the larvae would go in there. But you want to wait, because you don't want to throw on day one if they're going to sit there for 4 days, because other insects might be
Yeah. Yes. You tried to feed a corn silage?
Corn silage. I have not done anything with corn. corn silage. Cornmeal, yes, but not silage.
It's a good attractant. It's a good attractant for egg laying, though, the silage.
Is it?
Yeah. Anything fermented that I don't have the scientific data to back it up, but anything most fermented stuff, be it from kimchi that I over fermented or did something, works pretty well.
She knows that Robert and I've interacted a lot. He keeps telling me. I don't have scientific data. Because I would also say, what data do you have, Robert?
Yeah.
I have a question in the middle right here.
A concept I've been wanting to put a grant proposal together. It sort of involves the sort of a self-sustaining aquaponics situation where you're growing fish and then the effluent goes through and part of it grows vegetables conventionally in a regular aquaponics system. And part of it goes through grows aquatic plants, azolla and so forth, it feeds back to the fish. As part of that overall system, standalone system, I thought you also have a processing portion of the facility. Now you're cutting the fish, you got fish heads and the offal and all. You have the roots from the plants and all. You throw that all into some bins and then grow into the saltify larvae to feed them back as part of the fish feed production system.
Sure.
Ultimately, I guess maybe 50% of the feed I can eliminate, but ideally,
I think you
can 100%, you know, but that's down the road. But one thing that, when I mentioned that to feed the fellow at the university, he said, what about the, you know, with beef and all, you never feed beef scraps to the cattle. Is there any issue here with now these fly larvae
sure.
being fed off the fish offal, then going back into the tank? Potential there, but I don't know.
I mean, that's a really good question. I don't know if I have a direct answer to it. All I can say is that if we look at how most fish industry operate, they're capturing wild fish and feeding fish to fish. So I mean, it's part of the meal production.
It's a different species.
Yeah, but what happens, Jeff, is if you've got a diseased fish, especially in aquaculture or aquaponic settings, where you've got a confined high-intensity fish breeding operation, a diseased fish can rapidly develop within the system, and you want to remove it. So you don't want to then accidentally bring that back to the insect and then feed that then back to the entire stock
well,
that
one
you've got.
Does it actually make
and
it,
so
in its life
well,
cycle, does it actually?
We had a guy on Oahu that did exactly that. He took his all of his fish guts and trails, everything, and fed it back. And after a while, the fish stopped eating the black soldier fly. And he
was
pretty...
Was that Glenn Martin?
Yeah, no, it was not Glenn. And so that was a problem. But probably what it was is the fish was adapting because there were certain pathogens or disease vectors that were being cycled. And so...
One person I would contact is Dr. St. Hilaire.
Yeah.
Dr. St. Hilaire. I'm sure I'll let you get her name. You can look her up online. That's who I worked with that did the fish study. She's a fish veterinarian. And she was specifically feeding fish offal to soldier flies and then feeding the soldier fly to trout. So she's doing exactly what you're talking about. So she would be the one that's probably up to date on.
I figure USDA, if I get the grant, they
might
tell me why the comments
come
back.
Oh, yeah.
So this is her name, St. Hilaire. It's supposed to be St. Hilaire. ST period H-I-L-A-I-R-E. She's at Idaho State University. Yeah.
Can we get a copy of your presentation? And,
you know, I'll give it to Robert. Maybe he can post it online for you.
Yeah, what I'll do is I'll... Is it okay if I post it to Facebook/BlackSoldierFly?
Sure.
Okay.
This is her name right here. But she's at Idaho State University. Oh, also, my webpage is forensicentomology.tamu.edu. All of my papers are available there, all of them. So if you want to read them, you can download them.
Could you make that again, forensic entomology?
Yeah, let me put that up for two.